Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. At least 30 people have died and more than 200 are wounded from Tuesday's attacks in Brussels, Belgium, at the airport and at a subway station just blocks from the headquarters of the European Union. The attacks underscore the complex puzzle of international affairs that awaits the next president of the United States. Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas yesterday shared his thoughts about the Brussels attacks and criticized President Obama's record in the process.
It is long past time that we had a president who will acknowledge this evil, will call it by its name, and utilize the full force and fury of the United States to defeat radical Islamic terrorism, to defeat ISIS.
This hour, we're talking about the foreign policy challenges that will face the next president. Joining us in the studio is the vice president for the Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, James Carafano. Welcome back.
It's good to be with you.
And joining us by phone from the World Policy Institute in New York, Jonathan Kristol. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
President Obama yesterday, in his remarks, spoke about the Brussels attacks and linked it with the idea about whether a country such as the U.S., how it can bring unity to the world. He spoke about unity in reflecting on the Brussels attacks. Jim Carafano, is that, he's speaking from Cuba. So
right.
there's an undercurrent there as well. But how does a president respond to something like what happened in Brussels the day of?
Well, calling for world unity is just stupid. And it's not stupid from the perspective that it's bad to say we should all, share in humanity. And it's stupid from the perspective it has nothing to do with the threat. So I was actually just in South Asia. I was in India. I was in Pakistan. I was in Australia. I was talking with folks from Malaysia and Indonesia. And what struck me is everybody has an ISIS problem, but it's all different, right? So in India, for example, it's just branding. It's a couple of yahoos in a garage that say, we want to be ISIS. In Pakistan, what you see is there are elements of the Taliban that want to split away from the main Taliban and from the control of Pakistani intelligence. And so they're declaring allegiance to ISIS as a way to kind of carve out an independent space for themselves. In Australia, it's you have a handful of ISIS people that have gone to Syria and Iraq. They have not come back, but they have virtual links back into the communities in Australia, and they're communicating with them. It's different in Malaysia. It's different in Indonesia. I had folks come back from some of my analysts just came back from the Middle East and Jordan, Turkey. Different there. I had a team of analysts in Western Europe. It's different there, and it's different in the United States. So the problem is ISIS is a global threat, as is al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's actually come back. People don't know about that. But it manifests itself different in different places. So there is no one-size-fits-all, uniform, easy-button, bumper-sticker answer to dealing with the global terrorist threat. That's just the reality of it.
Jonathan Kristol, what about the president's remarks yesterday about the attacks in Brussels? Was it just pablum, or was there something more substantive there that you saw?
No, I think I tend to agree with Jim. I mean, I am not as hard perhaps on the president's remarks because I think he is saying what he thinks a president should say. If he was saying that in terms of an actual set of policies and bring the world together, then it is a downright pablum, and it's kind of nonsensical. I don't think that the president has a coherent strategy for dealing with the Middle East in general, or ISIS in particular. And I don't think that's actually a controversial position to take within the foreign policy community. I think there's fairly wide agreement on that. I don't think he was putting forth a policy, but I don't think he was intending to do so either.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about foreign affairs as they relate to the upcoming presidential election. My guests, James Carafano, he's vice president for the Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He's here with me in the studio. And by phone from New York, Jonathan Kristol of the World Policy Institute. If you have a question or comment about foreign affairs as they relate to presidential politics, give us a call, 614 292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what about what Jim Carafano just said, Jonathan Crystal, about how it's really a different game in every country when you're talking about something like these terrorist networks, ISIS, whatever?
No, Jim is exactly right about that. And I think that what we need to is have a kind of multi-leveled approach to fighting ISIS, which we do need to do. We need to be fighting ISIS. We need to be conscious of Al-Qaeda. We need to try to be aware of other groups that we may not pose as great a threat now and that might in the future. And what I think that requires is on a tactical level, working with our allies, with our friends and our frenemies on the local level. And I think it also warrants a global counter-ideological struggle that we basically saw in the Cold War, where we were had a containment policy towards an ideological enemy. We're facing an ideological enemy now.
But it's not a nation state.
Not a nation state. But, you know, we combated communism in a variety of ways, not just militarily. And I think we can combat radical Islamic extremism as well. That's not to say we don't actually put boots on the ground in places, and it's not to say we don't have intelligence collaborations. That is absolutely vital. But I think we can approach a general holistic problem while also dealing with the very specific differences in groups and the different needs of some of these states on the ground. Like, for example, if you take Tunisia, which is an interesting one because it has a very high number per capita of young people joining ISIS, and Tunisia is also, for now, a reasonably functioning democracy that is very worried about what happens when those people come back. And they've come to the United States, and they've asked us for help and development and military aid. And I, in my own opinion, I don't think we are, and I think in the opinion of the government of Tunisia, we are not providing anywhere near the assistance that they are asking for. And why aren't we doing that? I think that the president doesn't want to get involved somewhere, even where we're wanted, and even where we could do a lot of good at relatively low cost by just fortifying the border on the eastern side. And if our thing is we want to show that Western democracy or a local type democracy, but that democracy and kind of the free market, it can provide some outlet for this and can work in the region, I'm not quite sure why we're not supporting those states that are on the road in that direction now. I mean, and that's just one example. I think that's something we could do there. And it differs from place to place.
Jim Carafano, what do you make? How does the U.S. decide where to put its resources? How does it decide not to invest a lot or much at all in Tunisia, for example?
So I actually agree with the Tunisian case. Tunisia is a great example. It's the one country that arguably is a success coming out of the Arab Spring. They want to embrace democracy.
Right.
They want to embrace free markets. They want a freedom from
their
country.
They're relatively well-functioning.
That's a very relative word. Their economy is in hard, difficult shape, and making the transition to a market economy is very, very difficult. And they're under incredible pressure, not just from their own foreign fighters, which have gone to Iraq and Syria, largely for economic reasons, but also because of the proximity to Libya. So that is a country that is deserving of a lot more U.S. support. And it is strategically important because it could be the anchor on a line of U.S. allies running through the Middle East, which could serve as, in a sense, a firebreak to the spiraling out of control there. So you could go from Tunisia to a Morocco, potentially to a more stable Egypt, to an Israel and a Jordan, and then the anchor gets a little sketchy there. Does Iraq remain a coherent country? Mm. Does Turkey remain somebody you can work with? But I can see a line of bilateral alliances that the U.S. could use as kind of a firebreak. But here's one thing, as we look at all these things, that I do think there is one thing in common with this whole phenomenon, and that's what's really fueling the fire in the current expansion of the global Islamist insurgency is the fact that you have a declared functioning caliphate in Iraq, that ISIS has territorial control of a third of the country, so functionally a state. That is the animating force for this current wave. And in some cases, it's just inspirational. In some cases, it's aspirational. In some cases, it's the foreign fighter networks. In some cases, it's actually linkages, virtual linkages into a country. But ISIS is feeling this, and I have argued that unless you break ISIS territorial control of Iraq, and I put Syria in a different category because I think Syria is kind of an unwinnable, unworkable mess. But unless you break ISIS control of Iraq, take down the black flag in Mosul, that it's hard to see how you put the brakes on this current trend. And then there's the question of what is it going to take to do that?
So you're sort of you're saying go for the mother lode, go for where the big vein is first, because these people who are inspired in Brussels or aspirational somewhere else, they're the needles in the haystack.
I think you've got to do both. I mean, I think you've got to take out the heartbeat of the insurgency. But I do think you have to deal with some of these issues, and you have to rack and stack and prioritize them. So just you got to forgive me. A bizarre example that nobody talks about: Trinidad.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So if you can find Trinidad, it's a small Caribbean country. Mm-hmm. It has a small population of just a few million. It has a minuscule Islamic population of about 60,000, and about half of them are Indian Muslims, pretty non-political, and the other half are African Muslims. That portion of the population has become deeply radicalized. Actually, it was folks from Trinidad that had planned the JFK terrorist attack that people might remember. They were going to bomb the gas lines and, you know, blow up the fields and the whole airport. That group has always been deeply radicalized. They are also the center of the organized crime in Trinidad. So they run the human networks and the drug trafficking and everything else. They're in ISIS. So they've gotten like 90 something foreign fighters going there. So, I mean, proportionally for the population, that is a huge number. And if you think about it, that's not that Trinidad's this great threat, but nobody, you don't think of checking somebody with a Trinidad passport. You don't think of even a Muslim coming from Trinidad. So talk about a threat that could come out of left field. Trinidad.
Well, I would think about it now that you've told me about it. I would imagine the U.S. State Department's aware of this. Jonathan Crystal, I mean, you said, oh, yeah, when he brought up Trinidad.
Well, I mentioned, I don't want to harp on Trinidad too much. It's actually one of the nicer places I've visited. But they are the only state in the Western Hemisphere that has already had a radical Islamic takeover of their government buildings. And this is about 20 years ago, and it was put down fairly quickly. But I think Jim's point is well taken, that these are threats that can show up almost anywhere. And I think he's also right that this has to be taking out the source is not going to solve the problem, mm-hmm. But it is necessary. And we need to have, and the part where I am deeply skeptical of the current administration, and I'm also deeply skeptical of every other candidate running, whether they have a plan to deal with this in the future, is we need to be ready to take out the ISIS territory in Iraq, and we need to be ready to take out their fallback position in Libya,
right.
And we need to be able to deny them the ability to fall back to anywhere else. And it is this central source that allows them to operate in ways that were not as open to Al-Qaeda, not just technologically, social media, and things like that. But it allows operating in that region is a tremendously disruptive for a variety of reasons. For one, they, like Europe, ISIS has a strong interest in stemming the flow of refugees. Because if you have developed this caliphate and you are saying it's the perfect place and Muslims should come and live there, well, it doesn't look that good when everyone is trying to get away.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do? Well, you try to weaponize the refugees. You do try to insert terrorists in them to launch attacks. We saw that in Paris. I think we'll see that again.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can turn off that flow, then you don't see, then the caliphate, you know, doesn't look like a failed state.
eventually, if they're staying, it looks like they're staying because it works. We are going to continue our conversation about international affairs, foreign affairs, as they relate to the candidates for president, all five of them. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Earlier this week, every presidential candidate but Senator Bernie Sanders spoke before a meeting of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Topics included terrorism, security, and the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal. Former Secretary of State and Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton reiterated her pro-Israel stance and criticized GOP frontrunner Donald Trump.
We need steady hands, not a president who says he's neutral on Monday, pro-Israel on Tuesday, and who knows what on Wednesday, because everything's negotiable. Well, my friends, Israel's security is non-negotiable.
We're talking about how international affairs are shaping the race for the next U.S. president. So with us in the studio, Vice President for the Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, James Carafano, and, pardon me, by phone from the World Policy Institute, Jonathan Crystal. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I guess I want to ask both of you, are any of the candidates prepared to take the helm when it comes to foreign affairs? Jim, you and I were talking off the air, and you said, I said, why doesn't everybody just know that Libya comes after Iraq when it, you know, in terms of ISIS, if they are forced out of Iraq, they'll head to Libya? And you said, well, this is our day job. Is there anybody running for whom who could manage this day job of foreign affairs?
So first comes the caveats. I work at a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, so we don't take positions.
It could be a yes or no answer if you want
We don't take positions. But here's what I will, and I think a lot of people don't know this, is we brief candidates all the time and provide information to candidates. We provide them the same information that we provide to the general public. And so I've actually talked to shockingly, I haven't gotten many phone calls from the Bernie Sanders campaign, but I actually, you know, I've talked to all 15-ish, Republican, either brief the candidates or talk to their policy directors or policy teams and stay in contact with them. So I do kind of have visibility on this. So there's a couple of things. First of all, when you're running for president, here's a big problem. You're not the president, right? So you're not the president until January 2017. So saying what your policy is going to be in January 2017 is really hard, right? So you don't know what the future is going to look like. So you don't know, is Mosul going to in Iraq, the capital of ISIS, going to fall or not? You don't know, is there going to be another terrorist attack? So in one sense, you're kind of hamstrung by the people are asking you, what would you do today, when what you would do today is irrelevant because you don't get to do that,
well,
right?
Aren't you also hamstrung by the fact that you're not president, so you don't know everything the president knows?
Not
so much?
I have to be honest. I don't think so because, I don't know what the president knows. And sometimes I think I feel like I have a lot better handle on things than he does. But the other thing is you're running for president of the United States, right? And domestic politics and foreign politics are completely different, right? Mm-hmm. In domestic politics, if you like Obamacare and I like Obamacare, then I like you and I vote for you. In foreign policy, it's exactly the opposite. Most of us aren't foreign policy experts. We know we want to be defended. We know we want to be secure. We know we want America to do right in the world. And this is the way we do that. If I like you and you say invading, putting boots on the ground in Iraq, then I think that's a good idea, right? So we tend to agree with the candidate that we like, right? Okay. And that's very, very consistent with very few exceptions in history that we can talk about. But so what candidates are saying are not policy. What candidates are saying are things to get people to agree with them and vote for them, to think that I am with you. So when you say, I can't understand a foreign policy agenda from listening to Donald Trump, dude, that's not what he's trying to do. And that's true for Hillary Clinton. It's true for everybody. People forget that in 2008, Barack Obama and John McCain ran for president. They said virtually the same thing during the campaign. I mean, if you actually took away who said what, I bet you, you know, half the time people would guess wrong who did what.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you could predict the kind of foreign policy Barack Obama was going to be based on what he said in the campaign. And I don't think anybody thinks that Barack Obama and John McCain would have been the same kind of president. So this notion of is I don't understand what your foreign policy is from listening to these speeches and your long list of campaign advisors. Well, you know, wake up. And here's the thing, not to run on here, but and I've seen this is as you get closer to the convention and as you get into the general election, the people that are more influential in the campaign are the political people and the policy people matter less. So as you move on, the political people are saying, this is what we're going to talk about. These are decisions. And they may call the policy guy to say, hey, what do we say about this bombing and whatever? But then they tell the policy guy to go back and shut up. So policy guys are always sitting there for, well, we should have an in-depth policy. And they say, dude, no, we should get elected.
Right.
And that's what their campaigns are focusing on. And honestly, what else would you expect them to do?
Hmm. Jonathan Crystal?
You know, I would say I agree largely with – so I should also give the same caveat. You know, I work for a nonprofit, nonpartisan think
right.
tank that we have no official – the institute has no official position on anything. Personally, I think that that's generally true. And I think what Jim said about speaking to – for the election and policy, and speaking specific policies are very different. But, you know, I would also say, though, that – I think in this particular election, you have someone like Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders who don't seem to have any real interest or Sanders, in some cases, in a long history of being in a position to learn and talk to people. It hasn't shown any particular interest in foreign affairs, and I don't think Trump really has either. His foreign affairs are just seem to be based on having friends and kind of spouting nonsense every now and then, but that seems to have worked very well for him. And I think in this election, there are rather than focus on policies, I've been thinking about who do I actually think has the mental capacity to think about these things in a nuanced way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's actually been at the very start of the campaign. There were probably a lot of people who I think could do that, whether or not I agreed with them and what their positions would be. As we've gotten down to the wire here, I on a personal note, I am not planning to vote for Hillary Clinton. I don't really want to, but nor do I for anyone else in the race. But I think that she seems to be currently in the race. She seems to be the only one who is, at the very least, able to formulate coherent responses to any of these things. They're not necessarily the right responses. I'm not saying they're the wrong responses either.
She was Secretary of State, and at that time in her career was right. probably one of the periods when the most white male Republicans in the country thought highly of her. That's when some of her highest approval ratings were. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. So go ahead, Jonathan.
I think that she has the qualifications. I think some of her decisions as Secretary of State were incredibly flawed and dangerous, not least of all the intervention in Libya, which I think is one of the great foreign policy mistakes, you know, of the last decade.
Mm.
Certainly the greatest mistake, I think, of the Obama administration. I think her handling of the Russian reset is also proven to be an outright disaster. So I don't give her all sorts of great kudos for her time there. But on the other hand, in what I think is a weak pool of outcomes, at the very least, she has some idea about how foreign policy gets made, and she's not yet calling for policies that I find to be outright dangerous, like Ted Cruz talking about patrolling Muslim communities.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that. So.
And Trump calling for banning Muslims. Yeah. I mean, these are things, you know, in New York it's a little bit different because I end up talking much more to foreign governments than advising political campaigns, though we're always happy to talk to whoever wants to talk to us. And, you know, one thing, here's an anecdotal bit, but I hear this a lot. A friend from Sudan who has three kids, two of them are in school in the UK, one of them wants to go to school in the United States. That's great. We should want that. She's very scared. She doesn't want to send her son to school in the United States because she's afraid they don't quite get that Trump probably isn't going to win. And they're afraid for safety, I mean, physical safety. And I don't think we want to be in a position where Muslims around the world feel like they're going to be in physical danger from coming to the United States, particularly people who want to come here and actually want to assimilate. And I think that we don't want to make the mistakes that the Western European countries have made. And we have done a pretty good job of not making those mistakes. And my fear from some of the things that Ted Cruz has said in the last couple of days is that he's actually calling for policies that might produce the same bad outcomes that we've seen in our Western European allies.
I just want to take a quick call from Fred right now. Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hi. You know, at the top of the hour, Ted Cruz says that half of what we need to do is properly name the enemy. I find that very irritating, but that's half of what we need to do. I also don't agree with the name he's given to it. What do your folks think?
And thanks, Fred, for that. I wanted to take Fred's call up because it kind of goes back to what you were saying, is when Ted Cruz is saying that, is that it's just appealing to the largest common denominator?
Well, so that's interesting. Well, first of all, I actually blame the rise of anti-Muslim attitudes in the United States less on some whatever, pick your vitriolic voice or whatever, and more on the policies of the last 8 years. I actually think this administration, by refusing to kind of engage in a discussion and put its head in the sand and really have policies that have inflamed. Look, what's making people fearful and nervous is not what somebody's saying. It's the terrorist attacks. I mean, we've actually had an increasing number of terrorist plots against the United States. So I really think it's a reaction to the failure of the last 8 years. And somehow it's kind of, you know, blaming the messenger. I'm not. So this somehow is this, the voices of empathy and moderation, in some ways, I think, have fueled anti-Muslim attitudes more than the other voices. And so I really think the first thing we need to do is have an honest conversation about that. You know, I'll just say, you know, so I listened to a long interview on Ted Cruz, not because I actually like to listen to candidates, but I was stuck in the chair at CBS and they were interviewing Ted Cruz, right? And they were kind of giving him the third degree on this thing. And when he actually, you know, when they got done explaining what he actually meant, he was actually talking about two things, which is called community policing and intelligence-led policing, which are actually common practices that are used all over the United States. So maybe
the point being for gangs and human trafficking in particular.
Right. So so if somebody said we should use more community policing and more intelligence-led policing, I'd say, OK. So
on that's what I.
Yeah. So on the particular use of the term Islamist, I mean, in fairness to people, we use the term Islamist at Heritage. And the reason for that is there's a long lineage in that term that goes back well in the academic literature into the last decades. And it was meant to differentiate between Islam, the religion, and political movements that primarily started in the Middle East, which claiming to be as religious parties were also adopting very authoritarian policies and visions, and, you know, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood. So that was a term that even people in the Middle East use to distinguish between just the religion and the political movement. So I'm okay with the term Islamist, and I'm okay with people who want to, if you want to impose that political ideology through the use of violence, I'm okay with calling you an Islamist terrorist. Now, what we never do is I never use the term jihadist, and I never use any other purely religious term, because in a sense that gives credence to the notion that somehow there's some authentic religiosity to that. So I do use Islamists, but we don't call people jihadists and other things. So.
And I agree entirely with Jim. I don't see any problem, and I don't think any, again, in the, not to speak for the entire kind of mainstream foreign policy community, but I don't think you see any real controversy over referring to Islamic terrorist groups or Islamist terrorism. I'm not sure that calling it that, I'm not sure why candidates, and it's not just Ted Cruz on this, but I'm not sure why candidates harp on it so much. I'm not sure why calling it that has any actual impact on people's lives anywhere, or actually has any real impact on policy. I've never quite understood that connection. But just on a matter of, so I don't have any strong feeling either way. But in and of itself, I don't see what's wrong with saying that.
Let's go to Ted Cruz's utterances about how he thinks local law enforcement should be involved in this issue. He said that local law enforcement should be empowered to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized. And his campaign later said that the law enforcement should be should target terrorism like they do the threats from gangs and human trafficking. Right. So, all right. So that I got that a little bit more than what he was saying. But it's been years that law enforcement has been fighting gangs, and also and only really very, very recently that they started going after human trafficking. And it's taken a lot of education, a lot of know-how to go after these things. Does your garden variety law enforcement officer, are they, forget about empowerment, are they prepared to go in to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized?
So here's an important caveat, which is law enforcement in the United States is overwhelmingly controlled by local communities. We have normally every state has some law enforcement agency of some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And the Federal Bureau does have like 50 some odd federal law enforcement agencies, the largest of which are the FBI, who do have some interstate jurisdiction. But virtually in every case when it comes to policing a community, that is the responsibility of the local community. And the President of the United States actually has zero voice over that.
Right.
So that's one point. The other thing is when you say community in the United States, what do you mean? Because if you have seen one community in the United States, you have seen one community in the United States. So, for example, there's a Bosnian Muslim community in St. Louis. They actually had a case of material support to terrorism. I think it was last year. They had a guy go over to Syria and they had two Yahoos here who were like funneling in money and stuff. The most shocked people in that community were the Bosnian Muslims who were like, we don't understand this. And it was actually the community which had very strong and deep ties with local law enforcement and the local JTTF. So the problem is when you say we've got a problem, you can't use these kind of broad brush things like the mosques. Well, increasingly what we're seeing is ISIS is not going into mosques,
right?
Because they know that's where the FBI is looking for them. So in the United States, mosques are not actually a big source of creating terrorists. Prisons are not actually. Now, that's not true. In some countries, mm-hmm. mosques are a source of raising terrorists. In some countries, prisons are a significant source of recruiting. But you know, it's like real estate. You know, you got to go to the market. You just can't make a general statement about this is what we're going to do across America and it's going to be the answer. But again, you know, I would say all these candidates are not offering answers. They're making statements to get people
voters
to vote for them.
Right.
And we need to kind of, you know, distinguish between that.
Right. Jonathan, I want to get your reactions to that. We need to take a quick break, though, so stay with us. Any more questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A landmark of President Obama's foreign policy is the deal struck with Iran to curb its nuclear ambitions and ease economic sanctions there. The deal was seen by some as a victory for peaceful diplomacy, but it has been harshly criticized by most Republicans, including GOP presidential primary frontrunner Donald Trump. He spoke this week before the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, criticizing President Obama, Democratic frontrunner and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and the Iran deal.
This deal is catastrophic for America, for Israel, and for the whole of the Middle East. The problem here is fundamental. We've rewarded the world's leading state sponsor of terror with $150 billion, and we received absolutely nothing in return.
talking about how global security issues factor into the race for the next U.S. Senate president. I'm sorry. Still with us in the studio is the vice president for the Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, James Garofano. And also by phone is fellow at the World Policy Institute, Jonathan Kristol. Questions, comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jonathan Kristol, I just wanted to get back to that neighborhood approach that Ted Cruz suggested.
Oh, sure. And I'll speak briefly because I think probably I have a lot more to say about
Israel.
The Iran part and that. No, I mean, I want to echo what Jim said. I don't have any strong disagreements with that. I think that, you know, this is one reason why I still walk around, take the subway, do whatever here in New York City, because we have a tremendous amount of community policing in a wide array of communities, and because unlike in Western Europe, those communities do not want this radicalization within them, and they are a great source for law enforcement in breaking these things up, and they feel a part of the United States. They have per capita of a higher income than non-Muslims. They are well integrated. I think the U.S. actually does a very good job at that, And so any attempt to kind of mess with that, I think, is a mistake. But as Jim rightly pointed out, the president doesn't really have any power to mess with it anyway. But if you don't mind, if I could just say about the Iran deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the Iran deal, I publicly supported. I wrote about it, and then I've since somewhat retracted on it. What I think, you know, this idea that we could have gotten a better deal is I think, kind of crazy. I think this was the best deal that we were possibly going to get from Iran. And whether or not we should have taken it, I think, is a reasonable thing to debate. And I think there are very strong answers, reasons why we might not have. But I don't think that there's some magical renegotiation that gets something else that we want. Iran is not going to give up its entire, like, panoply of geopolitical interests just to placate us. So I think that some of that is nonsense. Now, what I will say is that we did not plan well at all for the ramifications of the deal. And we have been so, the Obama administration has been so laser focused on preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons that it has failed to take into account what happens after the deal. And what I think we've seen happen is that we will allow Iran to get away with virtually anything. And we have a newly aggressive Iran, a newly empowered Iran, not from $150 billion per se, that's an exaggerated number that Trump likes to use, but it's true. They have access to a lot more money. They'll be rebuilding a lot of their infrastructure. And they have been, like Russia, testing limits and pushing out everywhere it can and seeing what it can get away with. And what we've seemed to reach this formula where we say, well, Iran can get away with anything as long as it doesn't develop nuclear weapons. Well, that's a great deal for Iran. So I actually think Iran will stick to the letter of that deal, because as long as they do, we're going to do basically nothing. I'm not convinced, and I know this is probably a little bit more controversial statement, but, you know, I'm not convinced that a nuclear Iran that was totally isolated and separated would not have made for a more stable region than what we're seeing now. My preference would have been for a well-managed post-deal future. And if you see, how does Saudi Arabia view this aggressive Iran? Well, the Iran-Saudi Arabia dispute, I think, is going to be that and Syria, and they're all connected in some ways, a driver of massive instability in the region that has potentially global ramifications. And brings in the United States and Russia in ways we might not want to be involved, and is a flashpoint for uncertainty and instability, both of which I think are paramount things to avoid. I get very worked up about this.
Reason. You know, Jim Garofano, you've said that the need to deal with dictatorships has bedeviled American foreign policy since the birth of the nation, I think is the way you put it, and that our track record in this arena is definitely mixed. You said our most recent presidents have done a particularly poor job of it. does that include the deal with Iran?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the president's is, you know, if you build it, they will come. If I reach out and I give you something, I'll get something good in return. It was the policy with the Russian reset that failed. It's the Iran deal, which I think is already showing that it's not working. I mean, I think we can all agree on is Iran is going to be a big problem for the next president of the United States.
Wouldn't it have been a big problem anyway?
Well, it's going to be a bigger problem now because you have an empowered and enriched Iran with a lot deeper ties with other countries. And so managing it is actually going to be a bigger problem than when Obama started. And I actually do think they'll be closer to a nuclear program. Certainly their missile program would be a formal one. And we're doing the same thing with Cuba. We're going to get nothing from that. So this actually gets to the point I was going to raise, which is what I call the Hillary Clinton problem, right? And again, this is not a partisan comment because I don't do politics.
Right.
This is just me as the impartial guy. So, but look, here's the reality of the race is there was never going to be a Republican candidate for president with national security credentials. I mean, that was the truth. And we started with the field of 15.
John Kasich says he has national security credentials.
John Kasich was a member of the House in the Congress like
100 years ago.
Well, maybe not. But but his credentials are the strongest, but they're pretty tenuous. So nobody could walk in and say, I have been in the eye of the tiger and the mouth of the lion or the face of the dragon, right? So, I mean, that was always going to be true for the Republican field. And for any Republican candidate to try to pretend that they are a credentialed national security expert would have actually made them look, I think less credible, right? But Clinton's got the opposite problem. You know, Clinton says I have all these credentials, but I think the Clinton record as Secretary of State is largely one of absolute inactivity or failure, and I think she'll be tied with everything done in all of the Obama 8 years. All of her advisors will be the same people, and so when she stands up and says I have a track record, whoever the Republican, they say yes, you do, and it's awful, right? And so said, well, you have no experience. So the debate's going to be between the person with no experience, who will be labeled the wacko, the crazy, the isolationist, the neocon, or whatever, versus the highly credentialed person who is responsible for all the terrible things that have happened to you the last 8 years. So it'll be interesting to kind of see how the fight plays out.
So let's talk about email from Mark and Blacklick. He says, it seems odd to hear the Heritage Foundation say that we should be doing more when they are committed to downsizing government and reducing the deficit. Where is the money supposed to come from to retake Iraq, step up monitoring of Trinidad, and everything else that is being suggested? And please don't say cut the fat. There's very little fat left to cut. Besides that, though, all these things cost money.
Right.
And to the community policing issue.
So, I mean, this is often when I get this argument, I mean, this is often the image in my head is the family around the dinner table and dad walks in and sits down with this dreary face on. He says, kids, we just can't pay all our bills this month, so we're going to have to cut back. And the kids look at him and say, well, dad, we just got to stop paying the mortgage because we're not cutting back on the number of Verizon phones in our minutes. You know, so the answer is there's a lot of money in the federal budget. If you get your house in order and prioritize your spending, we spend more on welfare than we spend on defense. Now, maybe some people think if you add up all the welfare accounts in the federal government, we spend more on welfare than we do on defense. Well, maybe some people think that's appropriate, but I would argue that. And then the real issue is entitlement spending, which is not just eating the entire federal budget, but over the long term creates unsustainable debt. So our problem is not that we don't have enough money. Is that we have real fiscal debates, and that's the issue. Heritage just issued a 10-year budget plan, which actually balances in 7 years. It fully funds defense, and I think it meets all the other essential elements of government.
What do you consider fully funding defense?
So look, I mean, the problem. One of the things we do is we do this thing called the Index of U.S. Military Strength, where we have a way to objectively quantify and grade the military every year.
Yeah.
And we look at what the military has, and we look at the threats, and then we look at the environment in which they operate, and then we give a score. And what we show is we're trending down. We've got real readiness issues. And I think people have a hard time wrapping their head around that. But the reason is we've spent a lot of money on defense in the last decade. Most of it went to fund the war, and we've been kind of running the military itself into the ground, like driving a car and never paying for an oil change and maintenance and stuff. So those butcher bills are coming home to pay. How do you fix that? Well, you're not going to do what Ronald Reagan did. You're not going to walk in and do double-digit increases in defense spending. And there's two reasons for that. One is we also don't want to grow the debt because the debt's a real issue and a real drag on the economy. The other is we don't have the industrial base that we had 30 or 40 years ago. If you gave me another $100 billion, and I was the Secretary of Defense, I couldn't spend it, right? So I think defense is going to be a gradual on-ramp. We're going to probably peak somewhere around 4% of GDP, which historically spending, historically on average would be about half of what we traditionally spend on defense over the course from the end of World War II to present. But that's going to be, that will have to be paired with fiscal reforms that get economic growth, you know, above something of 1.5% and constrain entitlement growth for sure.
Jonathan Crystal.
I would also say, you know, I don't want to get into the budget. I think Jim did a good job of that, and we might have differences in priorities, although not so much on the defense side. But, you know, I would use the recent Russian withdrawal in Syria just to make one point. Is that, you know, we also, you know, one of the reasons Russia withdrew from Syria is they were spending too much money, in part because they have under sanctions, price of oil is low, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But we have forgotten over the last 15 years that you can intervene in a fairly narrow, targeted way, achieve limited goals, and get out. And, you know, Russia's out in quotes. But we have options available to us that are not go in, invade, and occupy a country for 10 plus years and try to create some sort of Western-style democracy where there might not be any particular interest or ability to do so. And so when people, I think, get upset about the cost in this, I think, and you know, I'm not a psychologist, and nor have I done surveys about this, I think that what they think of is the Iraq and Afghanistan war. But that's one model of doing things. And I think that there are other models that we can follow that are significantly more cost effective. But, you know, ultimately, if it's the number one job of the state is to protect its people and to guarantee the right to life of its citizens. And so if we are not doing that and we're unable to do that, that should really be the top priority in my mind over almost anything else that we do.
But that takes so many different forms today. It's not just about making sure we have enough guns in the shed to avoid an invasion or something like that. It's complicated. It's global. It's
extraordinarily
It's needle in the haystack. It's big, obvious threats, tiny little ones we don't even know exist yet.
It's extraordinarily complicated. There are something like Syria, I think, is a great example where there are so many issues intertwined that this small area can have global ramifications for years. If that conflict ever dies down, the refugee flow will likely increase. I mean, these are things that we don't think about, right? And it will continue to destabilize Europe because people who are afraid to leave before will be able to leave and they'll want to join their families who have now gone elsewhere. Everything is tied together and everything is incredibly complicated, but we can't, rather than throw up our hands about it, we need to develop some sort of strategy for how does America deal with the extraordinarily complex problems that the world faces. And it may not be that we try to solve them all. That might be completely foolhardy, too expensive, not a plausible option. But we need to prioritize and figure out, well, how can we, where do we need to allocate resources of all kinds, and what is our strategic vision that we can at least articulate to our allies and our enemies so that they have some sort of understanding of what it is we're trying to do.
We're out of time.
Oh, sorry.
But I want to thank you so much, Jonathan Crystal, for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jonathan Crystal from the World Policy Institute and James Carafano of the Heritage Foundation and here with me in the studio. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks for the emails and the calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.